Thanks for joining me. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. One of the fun things about my job is that when I go out to do an interview, it often takes place in buildings steeped in history. Recently, one sunny afternoon, I walked from our radio station to the Pantheon, if you're familiar with Rome. And on up a dark and narrow street flanked by ominously high buildings. I was heading towards a particular building which looks out on this street, one where Jesuits have lived uninterruptedly from 1570, except for those years when the society was banned. I was going to meet with a Jesuit. I rang the bell of the austere building where he lives and was promptly shown in. The bulky portal swung to a close behind me, shutting out the busy humdrum of Rome's street life. I blinked. I was stepping into an oasis of light, palm trees and all, where I found my Jesuit, who quietly showed me into a waiting room. I made myself comfortable and was absolutely sure his first words to me would centre round the topic of the interview we'd agreed upon, the liturgy. But I was wrong. His first words to me were about a well-known saint, Carmelite rather than Jesuit, Thérèse of Lisieux. It seems I was sitting in the very room where she had once been herself.
This very room was the place where she actually met with her spiritual director to ask advice about joining the Carmel at the age of 13, I think it was. And so the room has great spiritual and historical significance.
Where was Thérèse in Rome?
Well, she was coming to consult the Pope and to ask for an audience. She was discerning a religious vocation, but she was so young, of course. It was extraordinary that at the age of 13 she wanted to join a Carmel, and so she was here on pilgrimage and also to see the Pope and meet with her Jesuit spiritual director, which she did in this very room.
As he spoke, Father Keith Peckers, my Jesuit, who also happens to be an expert liturgist and published author and teaches at a couple of pontifical universities here in Rome, seemed to be doing some sort of disappearing act, sinking deeper and deeper into his chair. The athletic look he had was gone, and a wired intellectual energy seemed to exude quietly but forcefully. I felt safe at last because the Saint Thérèse digression, however much I appreciated it, had initially rather worried me. But I needn't have worried. Father Peckers is a focused man. The liturgy was to be the subject of our conversation. I must admit I began the interview rather awkwardly, muttering something about those long-forgotten, dusty Vatican wardrobes out of which had emerged, from mothballs, all kind of Vatican vintage vestments and other gear, liturgical and non, right since the start of Pope Benedict XVI's pontificate. The most striking of these garments, perhaps, being the retrieved fur-bordered red and white 12th century camauro, likened at the time to a Father Christmas hat. You may remember that episode. And then, after all this muttering, I came up with a question which I hadn't planned at all. One I think Father Peckers wasn't expecting. Just listen. Pope Benedict has a strong sense of the liturgy. Can one say he's a liturgist?
Well, he's not a liturgist in the strict sense of having been formed in the science of liturgy, but there's no question that Pope Benedict takes a much keener interest in liturgy than his predecessor did, than Pope John Paul. And so as a result, the Pope is more proactively or actively engaged in how papal liturgies unfold, and even, I think, to some degree, in aspects of a particular vesture that is being chosen and being used.
He's personally adopted vintage vestments for the liturgy, hasn't he? The question is, what do all these sartorial inventions actually mean at a liturgical level? They're just not quirks.
That's right, and of course the open question is that very one. Who's behind the changes? Is it the Pope himself? Would it be his new papal master of ceremonies, Monsignor Guido Marini? And it's just not clear to what extent it's the Pope himself requesting a return to certain forms of liturgical vesture, or whether it's the papal master of ceremonies.
They're symbolic, these changes, aren't they? Is it right to say that the liturgy is theatrical in a sense, that it's a visible expression of a meaning that goes beyond the visible?
Liturgy itself is an art form. We have many examples. Look at the way the symbols play out in the liturgy itself. Water, oil, light, fire, basic symbols that are used in the liturgy. And so liturgy itself is an artistic expression of what the church believes on a deep theological level. And therefore, vesture would be part of that. Vesture is always symbolic, the kind of chasuble worn by the priest or the bishop, the kind of stole, the way the altar is adorned. All of this is deeply symbolic as well as having a particularly practical feature.
So from what you were saying earlier, basically it's Pope Benedict who discusses with his master of ceremonies as to what vestments or how the liturgy is going to take place. But there are rules that are on the ground. For example, the colour of the vestment is already ruled in the liturgy, isn't it? You can't just invent it.
That's correct. I mean, largely it's the papal master of ceremonies who will be the one actually orchestrating and determining what is worn and how the liturgy is enacted. The Pope, of course, always has veto power, being the Pope, and can choose accordingly. But what both the Pope and his master of ceremonies have been saying regarding some of these changes is the idea is continuity, that the Church has a very rich tradition, a rich past, and this tradition also includes vesture and vestments. And so part of the idea is to draw from the treasury, essentially, both old and new. Therefore, very significantly, the Pope, when he was elected, returned to a form of the pallium, the outer garment that the Pope wears, which is symbolic of his link, the representative, the See of Peter, is worn by every metropolitan archbishop. But he returned to a form of the pallium from the first millennium, before the great split between the East and the West in the year 1054. And the Orthodox have interpreted this use of the older form of the pallium as a desire on the Pope's part to return to Christian unity, to symbolize that. So that's one example of how vesture can be symbolic. And that was with the former papal master of ceremonies, Archbishop Piero Marini, but clearly the Pope is desirous. We know how concerned he is about the unity of the whole Church, particularly unity with the Orthodox, reunification with the Orthodox. And this certainly was one simple but important way of actually putting that desire into practice by returning to a form of the pallium from before the Great Schism.
Because the Orthodox Church has remained more tied to its past, has it? Would you say that?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say. I mean, we have our own traditions, of course, in the West, very rich traditions here in the Church of Rome. For instance, the great Roman stational liturgy, which was in vogue from the 5th to the 8th centuries, which involved the whole city of Rome becoming a sacred space in a way. That tradition continues today, particularly during Lent, when the Pope on Ash Wednesday begins the season of Lent at the church at Santa Sabina on the Aventine Hill. That has been the designated church for the Ash Wednesday liturgy since the 5th century. So we certainly have our own link to tradition in the church in Rome. The Orthodox perhaps have retained a bit more of their own liturgical diversity, church to church or patriarchate to patriarchate, but we certainly have a rich tradition as well in the Roman Church.
Does this trend, can we call it a trend, does this liturgical trend represent a break from the recent past?
To some degree it does, because at the Second Vatican Council there was a certain abandonment of particular forms of vesture in favor of a more modern a type of approach of the outer garment the priest or bishop wears at Mass, the chasuble, for example. This pope has returned to wearing certain things, the camauro outside of the liturgy, kind of the red velvet cap with the white ermine trimming the cap, for example, that had not been worn for some time, returning to a papal throne of Leo XIII. We now have seen a return as well to a pastoral staff that is an older form of the pastoral staff that the Pope carries in procession, with a cross on the top of it rather than the curved sort of cross that Paul VI and John Paul II would have carried. But the idea, as the Pope mentioned, and his Master of Ceremonies has been, again, one of continuity and tradition and drawing from the past these various elements, these very symbolic elements within the liturgy itself.
But there you mentioned a number of different things. I mean, the camauro, for example, is something he doesn't wear during a liturgy.
That's right.
Whereas the pastoral staff, he might. So there are two different levels there, aren't there?
Very much so. We were talking essentially about papal vesture that would be non-liturgical, or the mozzetta, which is, again, the sort of short cape that the Pope wears, or had worn at least in the past, in the wintertime, a red velvet cape with white ermine. The Pope has reintroduced the spring mozzetta, essentially, the white silk short cape with the same fur, which John Paul never wore. But I think there's also a practical nature. The Pope is 81 years old, and he probably, presumably, gets cold, particularly in the Apostolic Palace. And rather than simply putting on a sweater that may be white, I suspect he figures, well, why not use something that we have in the tradition that popes in the past have worn to keep their head warm in the winter or to keep their shoulders warm in the cooler weather. So I think there's a certain practicality as well that's at play here.
Which there always was in the church, because, I mean, the priests used to wear skull caps because of the chill and the
exactly.
Medieval cathedrals, etc.
In fact, the origin of the pastoral staff was that it was a bastone, it was a cane. And in the processions during the Roman Stationer Liturgy, for example, the bishops of Rome and other bishops in other cities where the liturgy took place needed some help in walking, and therefore they began incorporating, using this pastoral staff, which was gradually, over the centuries in the medieval period, stylized to take on a more symbolic role. Even the ring that every bishop is given at his episcopal ordination, that ring was initially worn by all Christians, essentially to stamp a document, to seal a letter or a document. And gradually the ring then took on a greater significance for bishops in the 7th century of essentially symbolizing the marriage of the bishop to his church for which he was ordained. And today that remains the significance of the ring, that it signifies the bishop being married to that particular local church. That's why even bishops who work in the Vatican who don't have a particular diocese must have a titular diocese that is now perhaps defunct, no longer in existence, but they must be wedded to some diocese in order to be ordained a bishop. You can't be ordained a bishop simply ad hoc without a diocese, and that's why even curial bishops in the Vatican, when they're given their ring, they are wedded to a particular titular diocese.
The Pope can choose from vestments down the centuries from different papacies, you know. I mean, he could choose from the more recent ones and from the most ancient ones. How does he go about doing that, in your opinion?
Well, I suspect he relies a great deal on his Master of Ceremonies, who would advise him on various types of vestments. On the other hand, the Pope himself is an artist. He's a musician. He's quite well acquainted with the tradition of the Church, with its artistic heritage. And he would have, I think, quite a good knowledge of what had been traditional vesture over the centuries. We know that the Vatican, the papal sacristy, that many vestments actually were destroyed during the French Revolution, to basically burning vestments to get the gold out of them. But there were some vestments that were able to be preserved during the French Revolution. And we know that recently, for example, some of those vestments, chasubles, dalmatics worn by deacons, were able to be taken as kind of models to be copied. And there is a investment company in Northern Italy that has been involved now in attempting to restore or to copy the patterns and the forms of vestments from the 15th century before Trent, or even from after Trent. The Pope, for example, on Good Friday this year wore a red, typically called fiddleback vestment, Tridentine vestment in the good
fiddleback?
Fiddleback, as it's popular, you know, kind of commonly called, basically a chasuble without sleeves. And it looks something like a fiddle, and therefore it took on the name fiddleback. But this would be a more classically 18th, 19th century vestment that was quite different from the more ample Gothic type chasuble, pre-Tridentine Gothic chasuble. And the Pope wore that particular vestment on Good Friday. So the idea that we've been hearing is this variety of tradition and using all of the tradition within the church as far as its vesture goes.
Of course, if one goes to any cathedrals from old times, for example, I was thinking of the Cathedral of Monreale in Palermo, where I recently went, and they have vestments there and glass for tourists to admire. So there must be a lot to learn from those sort of vestments as well, no?
That's right.
Draw inspiration from, anyway.
Very much so. And even if you look at, go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, or many museums one could name, it's quite interesting to look at the form of the chalice, for example, when people were still drinking from the chalice, being invited to drink the precious blood before the year 1200, say, when that no longer continued to be the case. Because there you find cups that are much larger because they were intended for common usage. The chalice is much grander, much larger, whereas gradually as the chalice became reserved to the priest or the bishop, the size changed as well. It wasn't necessary to make such a large cup. So again, we can learn a lot from just simply by looking at the artwork, by looking at the vessels and the vesture. We learn a lot about liturgical history and how the liturgy has evolved, in fact, over the centuries.
In terms of symbolism, there are a lot of animals, and like, for example, a pelican symbolizes something special in the liturgy, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, we speak of, we have all sorts of things, pelicans and peacocks, and the idea is very much drawing on the tradition of that nature is incorporated. As I mentioned earlier, liturgy itself is, obviously, it's richly symbolic, and images of the water of life, or the waters of life, images of paradise, images of immortality and eternal life. These are often embodied through animals. Even if you think of the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they have often been symbolized through various animals, through an eagle, etc., which is another way of the church's reverencing creation and using the gifts within creation as a way of promoting its own liturgical life.
A big thank you there to Jesuit Father Keith Peklers, an expert liturgist and published author who also teaches at a couple of pontifical universities here in Rome, including the Gregorian University. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening.